Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, I've got Sanya Venkatachalam, who's an early stage AI investor at Axiom Partners. Sanya, welcome to the podcast.
Christian, thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So let's start with Axiom. Headquartered in San Fran?
Headquartered in San Fran. So we are a relatively new seed stage venture firm. That brings together the best AI operators in market today to invest in founders using AI to change the world tomorrow. Pretty simple, right?
So Finstrat is the great fortune of having a number of venture capital funds as clients. And I can share that, you know, it's only until recently, last couple of years of my career, that I really had an appreciation for the entrepreneurial culture that exists in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. But given that you're there, you know, it would be great if we can get your perspective and to the degree that that influences Axiom success.
Perspectives on San Francisco and sort of the founder culture here?
Yes.
Absolutely. So I've been in San Francisco for over 20 years. And I have the luxury of not having to travel that much because, one, there's obviously a lot going on here, but most people sort of come through here. And the reason is really simple. There's a very high concentration of exceptional as well as high potential people that want to build things that change the world. And they can be founders themselves. They can be people that want to join startups. I cannot go down the street two blocks away and get coffee in my coffee shop without running into someone I know or someone who knows someone I know, and they want to start a company and they want to interrupt my coffee to have me sit down and talk to them. It is more vibrant now than it has ever been, including in sort of the dot-com boom and ensuing bust, which is when I first came. You know, we had this little lull, I guess, during COVID, which a lot of big cities did when people started to go remote and maybe take the time to go to fun places like Montana, where I guess you are, Christian.
Yes.
But that's completely different now. And what's also interesting is actually every single one of my portfolio companies, as well as most founders I meet, they are 100% in the office in San Francisco. So while there's appetite, obviously, to hire globally, and there's talent everywhere, if you're here, you're in the office, you know, every day. The idea of sort of working from home is not as popular as it once was because of the energy, right? So when you're starting something, and this is why the concentration of people here is also exciting, there's just a lot of creative energy that helps accelerate and propel things forward. And that's really important.
Obviously there are talented founders and engineers throughout the world.
Absolutely.
But I find it fun to just highlight the culture that exists in the Bay Area, because for people who haven't visited before, I don't think there's an appreciation, to your point, of how it's so pervasive and in the company building that's taking place.
Yeah, sometimes it's actually hard to get away from it. When I'm with my kids walking down the street and I get accosted by people I know and people I don't know again, sometimes you do want to take a break, but largely it's great.
All right. So with that, in venture, there's a heuristic: source, pick, win, and sometimes, tack on monetize. So sourcing, any other insights or experience you can share with us of how you start to separate the signal from the noise when looking at opportunities?
Yeah, so we are extremely thesis driven. So This is was the founding principle of Axiom. You know, I was at Coastal Ventures for 4 years prior to this, and Social Capital before that. And we have a fundamental belief that within investing in AI, there are certain theses that are non-obvious, and we look for founders that are operating around those theses. You know, our philosophy really is we care less about AI for automation. We care less about some of the existing categories that, again, are a bit obvious, and more about building entirely new capabilities. So our sourcing comes in a couple of different ways. So, you know, I started investing in AI seed companies in 2017. I was led the Series A and Series B of a company called Grok, which now everybody knows about. It's an AI chip company that just was acquired by NVIDIA for $20 billion. But in 2017, that was investing in AI was highly contrarian. It was actually frowned upon, but it was investing in crypto. And I have been trying to nurture a community of founders that are building not for today, but for 2, 3, you know, 5 years out, which was, you know, originally Jonathan Ross's vision at Grok in 2017, is just coming to fruition now. This is what we look for. And so we go out and actively build community around founders that are building along these lines. We have founders that we could potentially back, but more importantly, we have founders at every different stage in this community, and we encourage them to help each other. And most of them we've never even invested in, but we have community dinners, we have a research dinner series, a founder dinner series. We have WhatsApp groups just to connect these folks. And founders are, you know, obviously encouraged to bring people into the network and into these events. But also, this is where we really get the highest quality signal of new founders. So this community of about 500 people, when they get a call from, you know, their buddy who's leaving Netflix or Stripe or, you know, name the company, and that founder says, "Who should I talk to? Not who should I raise money from, but who should I talk to? I'm thinking of starting this company. And I want to be, and I usually am, one of the first few names on that list." And the idea is I just go, I talk, I introduce them to my network, we help in any way. And that naturally leads to the second stage of what you just said, which is the winning or the picking, but then the winning. So there's no element where we're trying to win the deal, you know, during a capital raise. We try to establish that relationship and trust upfront.
And just, if we can take and unpack for a moment, I'll oversimplify AI and categorize it into infrastructure, tools, and apps. Is there a place in particular you find that Axiom's focused on, or you in particular?
Yeah, I'm going to create another category for you if that's okay.
Yeah.
It could be an extension of apps in a sense, but we think it's sort of what most people call the AI application layer is really just the tip of the iceberg. You know, that's usually the just the evolution of the $750 billion B2B software TAM that's been, you know, expanding since I came to Silicon Valley 20 years ago. But really is the evolution of current categories, right? So who's going to disrupt Salesforce? What's the next AI sales tool? Or who's going to disrupt Workday, right? The next AI HR tool or AI recruiting, or name your category. But, you know, we're looking for category creating companies and, you know, importantly, new transformational companies by definition rarely emerge from existing categories. So we actually find this application layer relatively uninteresting, again, from a pre-seed and seed stage venture perspective, which is where, you know, we largely operate. So what do we look at, right? So we start from first principles and we try to figure out what is AI capable of today? What is it relatively good at? but not awesome necessarily, but we think will improve. And what does that tell us about what it will be good at in 1 to 3 years? And today, what has become increasingly clear over the last 24 months is rather than just being the software that people use, these categories of software that I just articulated, AI has been capable of performing what looks more like the work that humans do, right, versus the software tools that they use. So if AI is moving from tool in a sense to worker and starting to do jobs itself, this is beyond software. These are systems that can act, plan, think, reason, and actually get real work done. And just to put a pin in that, usually when companies sell these types of systems, they are selling into labor budgets of customers, not software budgets. So this is where we like to think about and what we think is sort of the new frontier for the next few years.
So, separate but related subjects, what's your outlook then for the impact of humans as it relates to work?
Yes, so I don't have a crystal ball for,
Won't hold you to it.
five years from now, but I have a view of the next few years and then maybe 20 years from now, right? It's that middle that's often a bit hard. So in the short term, what we're seeing is there are a lot of areas where there is a shortage, especially of highly skilled labor. It's not just unskilled labor. And there are organizations that are actively looking to hire and can't find people. And this creates what we call sort of a capacity crunch. And a lot of our portfolio companies are building systems into that. So they're unlocking latent demand. They're not taking jobs away from anyone because, again, these are like recs that haven't been and can't be filled. And what that does is it actually empowers people. So, for instance, we have a company that's building an AI data scientist. They're not building automation tools for data scientists. I'm not trying to make the life of data scientists easier. There's people doing that. They're building a data scientist. And so there's only 3 million data scientists in the world, but the global demand for data science capabilities, if they were readily accessible, is probably a couple hundred million, right? So now the marketing manager in the Philippines or the construction CEO in Nigeria or even in San Francisco, right, who can't hire a data scientist fast enough has access to these skills. So we actually find this like relatively empowering. In 20 years, I'm actually hoping I become an AI chatbot. No, meaning I think that AI will be doing things that we can't even imagine. All of us will need new jobs. It's that middle period, right, of how the economy sort of shifts to accommodate this, which has happened in almost every technology transition that I think is more unclear.
So for the benefit of our audience, we're recording this middle of February 26. For those of us who are a little bit closer to this space, Elon has been saying something to the effect of, he thinks AI is overall deflationary. Eventually it replaces all currency because the robots will, do and make everything that we want. I'm not saying he's right. I'm not saying I agree with him. But there is an interesting implication, and that is, are you anticipate if you if we follow the crystal ball thread, are you anticipating a significant disruption to the existing SaaS ecosystem if AI's ability to write code continues to improve at the pace that it's at?
Yeah, I want to separate two things there. So there's what Elon is saying, which actually probably has some truth in it, but I think is sort of a longer term, more extreme view. With your immediate question of what does it do to sort of SaaS? So absolutely, I think the era of horizontal, shallow software that's sold in some kind of monthly subscription is reaching its end. I've been saying this for the last, 18 to 24 months. And while I haven't shorted, a lot of SaaS companies, I do think that this idea of actually going deeper and doing real work for people in a very customizable way is the future. So we at Acxiom are only just a few people. We have the luxury in 2026 now of building a firm with all of these new technologies available to us. So what would a VC firm, what should a VC firm look like? So we're building agents internally, using, and we only have like half a developer that basically help us scale. So we're building an internal AI lawyer, a couple of AI associates, some other sort of AI accounting functionality. And these are agents that are autonomously getting work done to make me look a lot more like a Coastal Ventures or a Social Capital where I worked before, that scale without having to hire that many people. So that's already happening today. And, you know, as I look at my portfolio companies who are doing similar things in other areas, they're not charging $20 a month. Right? They're not, you know, a 20K a year sort of mid-market SaaS solution. They're able to charge hundreds of thousands of dollars off the bat, even as like alpha product, because they're actually fulfilling this labor demand. They're filling job, you know, req. So I think that era is already coming to an end. If I can build my own CRM internally, vibe coding, we built our website in half a day vibe coding. Why do I need horizontal SaaS software?
And so, as you look back on any portfolio companies that you've invested in over the years, do you see a wholesale shift to just adopting AI-related features and functions, or are they redoing their strategy to figure out how they remain relevant, knowing that AI is democratizing a lot of the solutions that are on the market?
So, you know, 90% of my portfolio companies over the last 9 years have been, you know, folks using AI to build interesting new things. So I don't have that many companies that have to like flip a switch and now have AI features. But that being said, you know, I would say even the folks that started 5 years ago, right, that had incredible vision of let's use some of this technology, actually have to rewrite a lot of things because the models have changed, the technology is changing. And this is something I really encourage. Make sure you have an amazing end user product or value proposition, but be really flexible about how you build your back-end architecture because it will be obsolete in 18 months. Actually, your front end, your product may also be obsolete in 18 months. So you need to be thinking about what's next as well. But for sure, you know, every one of us is going to be, in a sense, rebuilding our companies constantly. But that's also exciting because we have so much opportunity, to do things we haven't been able to do before.
There's a parallel to software, obviously hardware. And, from where I sit historically, it's been the purview of corporate, not financial VCs, just given the CapEx profiles and vis-a-vis how much the majority or, I would call them the medium VC fund raises. Curious though, whether or not inside the halls of Acxiom, there's been any more discussion of taking closer looks at hardware backed companies, just given the what's the disruption that's taking place with software.
Yeah, so I sort of have two answers to this. We're a small fund. We just raised our fund one in sort of an interesting fundraising environment, and we were
Congrats.
extremely, thank you. We were extremely lucky to actually be oversubscribed. And I think this is just a testament to sort of our focus and the great relationships I had, you know, working at places like Hostla. So we absolutely, you know, don't even really think about investing in hardware companies themselves, unless it really is at the very beginning. Those companies obviously require lots of capital going forward. So even if the initial investment is small, it's hard to keep up with your pro rata, right? And you get diluted, so it's just a bit difficult. We also think that there's definitely been a resurgence in interesting hardware companies, both in terms of the evolution of data centers with all the hype around AI, but also in robotics and so forth. So I do think those will be the domain of both larger funds as well as alternate funding sources. And I think a lot of those areas are more obvious today. There's still chances to make money, but as I mentioned before, we're really trying to figure out what's next. Not what's next tomorrow, but what's next, right, in 3 to 5 years, and invest in that today. And we think that will largely be in software.
I'm curious when you so again, congrats on the fund. I'd be
Thank you.
curious if you can give us a sense how many of the LPs are first-time venture capital investors versus repeat ballpark.
That is a fantastic question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before. So we had a different model. We want our entire network to be value add to our founders. So I mentioned, we have these this core team, of 8 operating partners that comes from Google and OpenAI. They're founders from places like Replit and Fireflies, as well as we have the CMO of HubSpot. So from technology to finding product market fit and those early hires, early go-to-market experience, targeting ICP, pricing, et cetera. We have this model where people who are in market today, right? So not somebody who retired 10, 12 years ago and is just sort of giving advice. People who are in market today are helping our founders with the problems that they have, in market today. So we wanted our LP base to also reflect this. And so not every single one of our LPs can work with a founder, but we have an extraordinary number of operators and executives in the AI space. And we call upon many of them to due diligence or to mentor companies. And so I would say, many of them have invested in venture funds in the past, but they're more, let's call it operators, executives, people who have a vested interest and obviously have the wherewithal to invest in funds. And then we have, probably half, which are the traditional, more institutional funds that are used to investing in venture. So that's what we found to be relatively effective. And even some of those institutional investors are actually large multi-stage firms. We have about 8 of those as LPs in our fund. And that's a great value proposition for our founders because, we invest very early. We're very hands-on. We partner with our founders to try to add value. One of those ways is also by introducing them to some of the top-tier multi-stage firms who can do their Series A and beyond, and doing that early in sort of a more familiar way, right, or informal way versus, just when you need the capital.
So, it'd be great if you've had now exposure to multiple funds and their philosophy of engaging LPs. I'd love to, get your perspective on how Axiom thinks about it, knowing that this is, conceivably a 10-year plus relationship.
Yeah, and it's not just fund one, which is 10 year, right? It's fund two, fund three, fund four. So these are journeys we're embarking on for a really long time. We expect every single one of our LPs in fund one to be there with us in fund two. Many of them may be in an expanded state, so we expect fund two to be significantly larger. We take a very active approach with our LPs. Hey, if we're expecting them to help us, right, and help our founders, we want to, be a value and service to them as well. So, I think a lot of firms send like, a superficial quarterly update, right, and the financials, and maybe have, an annual, AGM. We actually send often weekly updates with insights on the market. We have calls with either our largest LPs or folks that are strategic who are interested in the insights of what's happening on the ground in San Francisco, in AI. And we're happy to do that because we get their perspectives and lenses from wherever they're operating, which often is a more macro perspective. And we can marry those together, right, and have great conversations. So this is something I think that attracted some really interesting LPs, in the ecosystem and new types of LPs, and we expect that to continue going forward.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing. So 20 years, can you, I would love to know more about where the career started and how it evolved to Axiom.
Yeah, I came when I was five, right? So,
Love it.
my founders always stay the same age, right? It's only us that seem to get a little bit older. So, I came out to Silicon Valley because this was the promise of, the dot-com era and the internet, and maybe we could connect the world in ways that previously were unimagined. I actually joined a data center hardware company. So that was my very first job. So it wasn't like a fun, sort of e-commerce application. And I became head of product. And we went from sort of pre-revenue, pre-product, pre-everything to $100 million revenue run rate. And we sold the company to Cisco for $1.5 billion, back in the late 2000s. And then I became VP of product at Skype. So went from hardware to software. This is when Skype was carved out of eBay. We ended up selling the company to Microsoft a few years later for $8.5 billion. This is also when I started playing around with data and machine learning products. So way back in like 2012, because we were trying to run some interesting experiments at Skype using this technology. And so basically, I've been hanging out with all the data and ML geeks, right, since then, learning from them, investing in founders, became a general partner at Social Capital, and where we were the first $55 million or so, into Grok, again, at a time when that was pretty contrarian. And then joined Kosala Ventures, where I was doing pretty much the same thing, AI seed investing, both pre-generative AI and then when generative AI became a thing. And we built Axiom just starting about a year ago, and are still very close partners with Kosala Ventures and other firms like that, because we, think that that ecosystem is just really important for our founders.
Fantastic. I'd be curious to know, like, just key lessons or takeaways over the years that have really stuck with you. And then, if I could also ask for, especially for the benefit of the women in our audience, anything in particular, as your role as a woman VC that kind of stuck with you, I think be valuable, especially just given that, there are not enough women in the asset class.
Yeah, maybe I'll start with that first, and then we can talk about sort of more general lessons. What I found is I've leaned in to being female. I've leaned into just being myself, and of course, that part of that is being female. And I haven't tried to be anything else, and that actually can create competitive advantage. So, my LPs used to ask me, like, what's your differentiator with founders? And I used to say lots of different things, but one of them is founders just really like to talk to me. I think it's I'm an empathetic person and I understand what they're doing, but part of it might be the fact that these are a lot of young folks that are trying to start their careers and do something really hard and ambitious. And I have two young children of my own now, and maybe some aspect of that comes forward in terms of I actually really want to help them. I try to take care of them, not just in their career goals, but make sure their health is okay. A lot of them come over to dinner to my house. Again, I don't know if these things are because I'm a woman or because I'm just that's my personality, but whatever it is, just lean into it. And if people don't accept it, that's fine. I actually think it'll be more of a competitive advantage. And if you work for a couple of firms and you don't find the right fit, this is the best time ever to start your own firm. Not necessarily the best fundraising environment. Those things go in cycles, obviously. But the ability to raise capital, the ability to build a firm with having your back office taken care of, your legal, using AI to build a lot of things, the ability to get your name out, right, on podcasts like this or in social media. So embrace it. And if you don't find the right fit again in a larger firm, have the courage to kind of just go your own path. And you will likely be, very, very successful. So I encourage more women to be themselves and also, for all the men out there to be themselves and have that authenticity be a source of competitive advantage. Other lessons I've learned over the years, more than anything, just know what you want and go after it. So that persistence and obsession, which is one of the things we look for, in our founders, I think is really important. I've had the opportunity to learn from folks like John Chambers at Cisco back in the day, to amazing investors like Chamath Palihapitiya and Vinod Khosla. And I think the number one lesson over the years, besides being your authentic self, is don't be scared to be contrarian. You want to be contrarian and right. Sometimes you'll get it wrong. But if you think you have a different view than the consensus, don't believe that the consensus, even in Silicon Valley, where there's so many smart people at the cutting edge, you might actually be right, and you can go make a lot of money by acting on that contrarian idea or thesis. And again, I learned from the best, as it relates to that concept.
Okay, so three threads then I want to pull on. Let's start with the first one. So my perception is that there are more associates or gunning associates than there are positions. Any feedback or advice that you would give someone who's interested in breaking into the industry of what they can do to increase the odds that they get hired at a firm?
So, Peter Fenton at Benchmark, who used to be my neighbor in San Francisco, gave me probably the best advice on how to break into venture. And he simply said, invest. Doesn't matter the brand of the firm, doesn't matter how much capital, just start investing. And in this sort of day and age where you have amazing platforms like AngelList, where you can participate in many deals at the early stage with very small checks, get a few people that believe in you to and just get some capital together, or invest very small amounts even of your own capital, and just get going. I think that's more important than going to school and going to get your MBA, even though I got my MBA a long time ago. And getting into the right firm. Often associates at a lot of these firms aren't even at the front end of investing. And we have a network of some amazing up-and-coming VCs who have done exactly this. They basically have gotten capital from any which way they can. They have very small funds and they had a bigger fund. And sometimes that will lead to, if your dream job is to work for a large branded multi-stage firm, just your angel investments are probably the best indicator for those firms. And then if it doesn't pan out, you just go raise your own fund.
I love it. I think it's great advice. All right, thread two. You mentioned founders. I'm curious. I imagine you've looked at hundreds, if not thousands, or met hundreds, if not thousands, of founders now. Common patterns of what you've seen as maybe being an indication of latent potential to become a unicorn.
Yeah, so one thing I've learned is, we look for qualities, not skills, because you can learn new skills or hire people that have those skills to complement you. but there are certain qualities. They're at least necessary, if maybe not sufficient all the time. Number one, if you go to our website, scroll down to the bottom, is what we look for. And we basically have a video running of Steve Jobs' narration of the crazy ones and his respect for those who, and it's a little cheesy, but we do it on purpose because it is the single most important quality, and especially in this era of AI, where almost anyone can start a company, and there are so many ideas that are obvious. Not all of them, in fact, most of them won't be venture backable. There'll be too much competition. The valuations are too fully priced in. So we really want that crazy idea that's bold, that's different than what people have thought of, and sort of the obsession to go after. So that's where we really start. Now the flip side of that, in a sense, is we need to find people who have the credibility to build the everyday plan, which is the company and the team, to achieve that crazy vision. We can't just have the dreamer, right? We need the ability for folks to hire and to inspire others, to raise capital, to build great product, all of those things which I think are more obvious, but it's that sort of balance, or doesn't have to be balanced, has to have both of those sort of qualities. And that's extremely, I think, rare, but is probably the single biggest indicator, right? Or recipe, in a sense, if there is a recipe, for potential to kind of build something amazing.
Third thread. And so this is actually going to build on your response. So thinking outside the box is coming to me, but okay, being a contrarian, you and I know that just because you're a contrarian on a subject doesn't mean the investment has legs. Curious if you've developed your own litmus test when looking at contrarian bets to say, hey, am I looking at this the right way?
Yep. So I think the first test is, is there anything in like the physical world that actually would prevent this from happening, right? So something could sound amazing, but like obviously, if it defies the laws of physics itself, probably not a credible enough journey to sort of go on. But I think the if you're asking sort of like, is this too crazy? I think the answer is actually no. Because what I found is things that we have thought would be crazy become mainstream and banal in technology, sometimes even within 18 to 24 months. And this has been a something that's repeated, I've seen Silicon Valley over the last 20 years. I think what's important, the litmus test, is that credible plan, right? So how do you get from here to there in really tactical ways? If you have a vision of rebuilding the medical system and primary care, right, via AI, well, what are you going to build first and sell tomorrow? Because we can't build companies in a lab for 3 years and all of a sudden have like this amazing new solution. Things have to come in sort of, I don't say increments, but milestones, and you need to make money, early too. So that's the litmus test, is there a credible plan that the founder can come up with that makes any kind of sense? So it's not, does the vision always make complete sense? Because sometimes it really is out there, but does the plan make sense? Does that make sense?
Does. Okay, so then I'd love to know if we were sitting inside Axiom's investment committee, does there have to be unanimous consent? I mean, agreement that move forward with an investment, or any of the partners allowed to say, hey, no, we're doing this, despite what anyone else thinks.
Yeah, so we're not a consensus-driven organization. And I know different firms have different views on this, but my mentors in venture had a view that your partners are really there to help you make sure you've thought about everything. So if they ask a question that you can't answer, like, go figure it out, and you should be able to answer it and make sure you have a lot of conviction. But if somebody does have tremendous conviction, this is where the outlier companies and returns really come from, at least in our view, and at the firms I've worked in the past. So it's usually not the one that everybody likes, right? But it's the one that most people weren't really sure about. This was the case with Grok at Social Capital. This was also the case, as an early investor in Fireflies, and we led the Series A at Khosla. It's usually the one that a lot of people weren't sure about, but somebody had really deep conviction and had done the diligence.
Yeah, no, I think that's great to hear, and because it seems as if some truth that if there is unanimous consensus, then odds are it's not disruptive enough, or
Again, there's some great firms that have that approach, so I'm not gonna say
we
anything
haven't said
negative
their
against it.
names. It's
But this is not how we do things, yes.
yeah. Before we wrap up, two more questions. One, retrospective, if you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self when you were first starting out, words of wisdom you would share.
Absolutely. So, I alluded to this before, but, I would have told my younger self, or I would tell my younger self that really not about talent. It's about mindset and perseverance. I again, I have two young kids, and we show them videos of like Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. And what's really consistent in a lot of what these sports champions talk about is the fact that they actually weren't that talented relative to many of their peers early on, but they wanted it more. And you'll hear, folks like Kobe Bryant say, all of my peers, would practice twice a day. So I woke up an hour and a half earlier at 5 instead of 6:30, so I could fit in one more practice. And that extra 45 minutes a day compounded over time, so that at some point I had so many more minutes of practice in than my nearest peer that I was that much better. And I didn't realize this when I was young. I was like, oh, look at all these amazing, smart people, much smarter than me, all these talented people. I need to find a way to become more talented, right, or smarter. And, it really is just the focus and dedication and perseverance, and being out there at 5 in the morning or 11 at night to keep practicing, that I think is most valuable. And again, it's what I'm teaching my kids. I'm putting my money where my mouth is, so to speak.
No, I love it. I think it was Calvin Coolidge, and he has a quote, but it ends with persistence and determination are omnipotent. I agreed. We'll see if we can't put it in the show notes, but it's been a couple of years since I found it. But someone, to your point, did an analysis on baseball Hall of Famers who had the best batting averages. And I think they asked him, I was like, well, how much more time did you, or, what'd you do? And they said, I just did an extra hour after, when everyone went home. And so the irony of it is, yeah, I mean, it's extra. Good news is you don't have to, skip the sleep. But yeah, just being consistent and doing it, what a difference.
What a difference.
Before we wrap up, would love to give you an opportunity to recognize anyone personally, professionally, who's had a positive impact on you. On your career over the years.
Yeah, this is going to sound banal, but I really do have to give a shout out to my spouse. I would not be doing what I'm doing today. I would not be building Axiom. I wouldn't have had the courage, especially, again, as a mom, to break away from, amazing jobs and firms to venture out on my own and pursue my passion. Without his support, and that support wasn't just in the last few years, it was over the last 20. So, other piece of advice maybe to my younger self, get married earlier. It'd have a more positive impact on your career. No, I'm joking. I definitely just want to give a shout out.
Well, thank you for sharing. And yeah, for someone who got, I mean, I don't have anything to compare it to, but having gotten married at 22, I would agree with you. And I do find myself in this conversation from time to time. And obviously it depends on the individual, but I think one of the things that happens, or one of the ancillary benefits of getting married that young and presuming you've got your head screwed on right, is that you end up working more because you're focused on taking care of your family. And so you accumulate a whole host of, experience, assets in your 20s that you probably wouldn't start thinking about focusing on until you're otherwise in your 30s. So I agree with you 100%, if that's what you're looking for.
If that's what you're looking for.
Yes. Sonia, genuinely appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Appreciate you coming on.
Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And again, Christian Marquez, Innovators and Investors Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.